Welcome to the No Film School podcast. Today, I, Gigi Hawkins, speak with Thea Hesvendahl, the director of the new neon horror film, Handling the Undead. And I think horror is an interesting word to use because this film takes the whole concept of zombies and forces us to look at the cold, hard truth of what happens when we lose the people we love. The film actually is more of a subversion of horror and the tropes of the films we know and love that are about people rising from their graves. And it creates this eerie and subtle yet rich portrayal of grief. It asks powerful questions, and Thea does as well, including who are we after loss? How do we deal with losing someone we love? And how do we, if possible, ever move on? The film reunites, and I'm sorry if I butcher this, Renate Reinsve and Anders Danielsson Lai of The Worst Person in the World. And it follows three families dealing with the sudden awakening of their dead loved ones in Oslo. This is Thea's feature debut. You may have seen her short, Virgins for Life. And it's based off of the cult favorite novel by John, again, I'm going to butcher this, Adjvid Lindquist, who also wrote Let the Right One In. And it really is a masterclass in patience and letting each shot carry us through. It's an execution that auteur filmmakers aspire to achieve. And in my conversation with Thea, we unpack her process, working with actors from pre-visualization to finding the story in the edit as well. And now my interview with Thea. Welcome, Thea. Thank you so much for joining us on the No Film School podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a great honor.
We are honored as well, especially we've been catching up with people at different stages of their festival experience, people who have yet to screen their film, people who are have just come off of screening their film. And now you have had a day of handling life post-premiere. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling very happy and relieved. And it feels like the audience and the critics have gotten the film the way I wanted them to get it. And I think that's all you can hope for when you're making a film, is like you want people to see what you tried to make it into. Kind of. Yeah.
Has there been anything surprising coming out of it where you're like, oh, I didn't expect this moment in particular to resonate?
Yes. Or I think during the world premiere yesterday, where we were sitting through the screening, and that was the first time with the full theater, people were laughing and I didn't expect that, but it's great that they do. Because before we only had like small screenings with few people in big rooms and then no one dares to laugh, you know, or at least you don't hear it. But the audience was really like one entity. So they were laughing at the same place, and like a person was like screaming really loud, and everyone's like reacting in the same way. So that was really fascinating and rewarding as well, I would say.
Yeah. Nice. Now, the film itself is just this incredible, it feels like a masterclass in letting the frame and letting the shots that you are choosing inform the story and how people are experiencing the story. It's fantastic. And I think as emerging filmmakers, it is a great thing to study as well. So the film, which is coming out with Neon very soon, is something that I hope people see in theaters and then go back to see it so they can study it specifically. But I'd love to hear about your pre-visualization process. Like, how did you go about creating what this film would look like and what specific shots you're going out to achieve?
Okay, so I think in general, I wanted it to be a bit more observational, but also an intention was to make the mise-en-scene and how the film is told through the images and the sound to tell the story rather than having it through dialogue or spoon feeding the audience. And I think that it's, you can rely on audiences actually understanding much more than what you think, as long as you give them like small hints. And that also, I think, makes the audience a bit lean more into the film. And personally, I find it more interesting when films don't spoon feed me. And I wanted this film in particular to have enough space for people to enter their own personal life kind of into the film, or have time to meditate on what is happening. And so that was, I guess, like one way to construct the film's visual language. And the other thing that I also thought was, because it's a very, okay, so a lot of the characters are in grief from like frame one, and I wanted them to have the space a little bit for themselves, so they have the time to be by themselves, or I don't know, I just didn't want to be up in their face all the time. So we had to constantly find, and I have a really great cinematographer as well. So we just went, we did a lot of storyboarding, and no, not that much actually, but a lot of like draft shot listing, mm-hmm. and going to the different locations and just trying out the mise-en-scene and seeing how it all worked out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Within, for example, a shot where you wanted to give a character space in grief, one of the things that I think is so powerful, and probably one of the things that the film will be recognized for, is the patience that you let, that you have with the characters, or specifically with the talent on screen, letting us be with them in that moment. And probably a reason why it's like something that feels deeply personal as you're observing, or almost voyeuristic as you're observing these people exist. How do you approach directing actors in that scenario, especially when it requires them to be present in the moment, performing for an extensive amount of time?
Yes, it does actually require a lot for the actors. And I also understood, like, while working on this film, that it's very different for an actor to like kind of like look for small moments and have these small moments of truth, and you can like edit between takes, etc. And which is very different from holding a take for a long time. But I was very lucky to have great actors, and they really gave their best all the time. And I had a lot of long takes, but they're amazing. So I don't know. They do most of the job.
Yeah. They make it
I
easy.
I just set it up. So yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk very specifically about how you work with them and how you set them up for success in those moments. In the past, on the No Film School podcast, we've talked to directors about just the dynamics of setting up blocking and staging with talent. For example, we had Kelly Freeman Craig, who directed Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret, which is a very different movie, but she took us through the steps of blocking a scene in particular. So I'm thinking off the top of my head of what would be an interesting scene to talk through. But if any comes to mind of like, how do we set up this moment and sort of like direct them towards what unfolds in that scene? Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So I'd love to hear like specifically, like do you start by talking to them about their motivations in the scene, or are you very like tactical? So like you are here and then you move here. What is that process like for you?
I guess it depends a little bit from scene to scene, but and also from location to location, because some location wants to be shot and there are not a lot of options to find the right image or make it fit into the style of the film. So then it's a bit more locked for the actors. But other times we also go to location, like that's the best thing. If I can bring the actors to location before, a day before or even earlier, so we can go through the scenes and block it. And many times it's very difficult and maybe we have to change the scene, or they come up with great ideas as well, and we just try to figure out like a movement that works nice. And then the DP is often there as well, like finding some framings that are working. And I think I think the more we can do like ahead mm-hmm. of shooting, the better. And that also makes me calmer, because then I know what kind of shots we're doing. And then you can always be creative on set, of course, but right. You have a plan.
Yeah.
Right.
You can always fall back on something that you know will work.
And then I think like the more that comes of the blocking that comes from how the actors want to do it, the better it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can always adjust it a little bit to the camera. But I think that's the best way to do it.
What was like an unexpected discovery in that process? Once you, were you eventually let go of what you had planned to pursue, something that you guys discovered on the day?
Absolutely. I mean, there's one scene where Renata, that plays the character Anna, she sees her son for the first time when he's undead. And she hadn't seen the boy. That was, she was very specific. Like, she didn't want to see the boy until she was going to see him in the scene. So we hid him from her. And then my thought that was that she was going to be like quite held back. So that was like the instruction that she had gotten. But we also wanted to capture that first take when she saw it, of course. And she just couldn't hold back. Mm. And it's a very moving scene. And it's, she plays it amazingly. And it's just, it's what came naturally. And that changed from what I was like imagining it to be. I thought it was going to be like a shot from the back, just see her through the door. And then us like imagining it, everything, or listening to the sound. But I think that it was really important actually to get closer to her at that moment. And it opens up in a different way. So her just playing that out was beautiful. And that's the shot that we ended up using.
It's interesting how you mentioned earlier about taking the time to give the characters their space in the beginning. But in this particular moment, you were, the camera's very close to her face and you're very much with her in it. And it is this, and up until this point, this is a character who's very guarded, clearly hurting so deeply, but not able to function around it. And then like you were able to capture this amazing reaction that in context, I'm like, oh, this totally makes sense to me.
That's yeah, so cool. But it definitely wasn't planned. So it was more like, and we were also a bit like, oh, fuck, this shot doesn't like completely match with the rest. But we were doing it anyway because we just knew that we had to capture the first one. So that was just unexpected. Yeah. But I think it works. But it is, as you say, like it takes you out from what you have already experienced. But as long as it works, then it's good. Well,
So there are two young actors in the film that I remember. I think two boys, one undead, one living, which, you know, of course, working with children is, you never know what you're going to get. I'd love to hear specifically about working with the boy who played Anna's son, who is, and how you got such a restrained, specific, and frankly, like painful to watch performance out of him.
Yes. So it's a hybrid. So we ended up with a hybrid solution because the boy is like really key to the whole story and he needs to be, as you say, almost dead, almost alive. So we did a lot of tests with children, but they're just too alive. So even though they're still, everything is like moving all the time. So we ended up actually using a mix of a real boy, prosthetics, VFX, and a doll.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You fooled me.
Great. So that was, yeah. So a lot of the times the actors were like just playing against the doll, but that also gave us a lot of space and time and made it easier for me to, or made me able to focus on the grown-up actors rather than the kid, because having kids in a scene kind of usually takes all the attention, I find. So I think it was actually, it worked very well to have a doll. We didn't have to think about the hours or restraints on the working hours. Yeah.
The doll is non-union and has...
Exactly.
Doesn't even get a bathroom break. That's a,
exactly.
We're here in Park City. It's very dry. I keep looking in the mirror and I'm like, oh, I look like the undead and handling the undead. Mm-hmm. My eyes are that glazed over and red, or, you know, slightly dead. But let's talk about the look of the undead people, characters. Yes. What did you call them? Did you
undead?
Just undead. Yeah, perfect. Call an undead and undead. How did you come up with the look of every movie that has an undead element to it? Are you getting, you have a sort of different look for your zombies or undead? I feel like it's not fair to call them zombies in this place. But yeah, talk to me about the look, the prosthetic, and how you got to the point where you're like, okay, this is what's consistent and true to this world and this story.
I mean, I did a lot comes from the book, like a little bit of like how they look, I guess, or like this, how they behave. But the book is also much bigger and a little bit different. But so it was like how they behave or walk and stuff that was testing. And I also used a movement coach that for somehow knows how to exit his own body and walk through walls, etc. So Whoa. He knew like what that feeling of having been a dead soul kind of was.
Wow.
So that was really interesting as well. So I used him a lot to just get into like their movement and how they would move their head slow, like with their body instead of going for the sounds and mm-hmm. just small mm-hmm. things. But I also found during the shoot that like the less they move, the better it is, because some undead tend to be funny somehow. Mm. Yeah. So it's a balancing act and to not make them look stupid.
That totally makes sense. Yeah.
And also like on the makeup side, it was a close collaboration with my SFX makeup supervisor, and he knew that for the human brain, it's actually more unsettling the more realistic it is and less like monstrous.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did a lot of research on like dead people and images and pathologists, and I wanted it to be as realistic as possible. So they should all be like the stages they were in when they woke up and then continuing to decompose a little bit while alive. So, but then we had to find out where the balance was also between them looking a little bit dead or scary, but also not being like too zombie-ish. And mm-hmm. every time we, or even if I came up with an idea, oh, she bite up all of the head, and it's, no, that's too zombie. I was like, okay, I agree. It's yeah. too zombie. So, okay, let's do the ear.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. So it was always this like balancing between everything. And he also had the great idea to, with the skin tones mm-hmm. and to remove it in post instead of doing the makeup, because then you keep all the structure in the skin and the texture and the small stuff underneath. And yeah, so yeah. that's what we did.
Cool. Okay. So this is a heavily VFX film, it sounds like,
yeah.
which it doesn't feel that way.
Wow. Yes, it has a lot of VFX. It does.
Let's talk about the post-production process. I had assumed that, you know, every frame had been planned before, and it's actually really exciting to hear that you were also flexing into, let's try this thing today, and having that creative process. But when you were, and this actually taps a little bit into the filming as well, but there are certain scenes that have maybe three shots total or two shots. Were you shooting in each shot the entire scene, which would then allow you to choose how you were entering each scene in the edit process? Or were you aware of this will be the first shot mm. of this scene that will then transfer into this next one?
Mm, probably doing a bit both, I mm. think. But I like, I mean, we also shot on film, so we kind of have to be constrained, like the amount we shoot a little bit. And I like that. And I also think, or I don't like to like cover a lot of stuff just to cover it. So I think we have probably less, or like we could have had a little bit more coverage. But I think it's, no, it's not always planned like what shot we're going to start with. But also some of the scenes only have one shot.
Right.
And sometimes in the edit, that can be a bit problematic, or you have to find like different solutions. But also I think that influences the film in the end as well, because you have to make this kind of, let's say you have to save the scene a little bit because, okay, we only have one shot and the last part doesn't really work, or we don't need it. So how do we then exit in the middle of the shot without it being noticed, etc. But then again, it also gives something to it that you can't always, I don't know.
Articulate.
Yeah.
Yeah. What were some of the puzzles you were solving in the edit process?
The end. I think when we were shooting the island, like the first day we were out, we were going to do the boat scenes, and there was a big storm coming. Mm-hmm. So we only got one shot, and then the rest of the day went to just like saving all the equipment, and it was like raining sideways and huge waves, and
Gosh.
A tree like fell over and broke the balcony in the house where we had all the equipment, and it was like It was insane. So we lost kind of a day there and we had to, yeah, so that we didn't have a lot of time on this island. And I think, and also not that much coverage. And also we had this drowned one that is a bit, he's harder to see too much, I think. So that like finale was, I think, the hardest part to solve. And it worked in the end with this montage and when we got the right music. And yes, now I like it, but it was hard.
Yeah. From a audience perspective, I was like, oh, it's exactly as envisioned. And again, so moved by the end and sitting crying alone, you know, the best feeling in the world. Yeah. Okay. So I'd love to sort of pivot now into talking about your, how you got your start. Like I mentioned before, we have a lot of emerging filmmakers. We have a lot of people who are obsessed with, in the best way, film storytelling, things that sort of blend and flex out of genres in unexpected ways. So how did you get here? Let's go back to the beginning.
Yeah. So I think like when I was a kid, I wanted to be a commercial film director, but then I kind of forgot about that. And I wanted to do something creative, but I was like, I can't sing, I can't play music, I can't draw. So, and I did well in history exam. So let's be a teacher. That was the idea. But I think until I had this, and I studied in England for a year, Spanish and history, and then I had this like light bulb moment. I was like, I can become a director. So that's how I was like, it makes perfect sense. And I think the films that led me into being really interested in films were Mulholland Drive and the films of Pedro Almodovar, which I watched a lot. So I loved films already. So then when I got the idea, I was like, wow, great idea. And then I went to film school in Norway, which wasn't very good, but I learned a lot and got some nice friends and made, of course, a couple of shorts there. And after, now I'm telling everything. Yeah, okay. And after school, I just continued to make my own shorts and music videos while I was also doing assistant jobs for bigger films and TV series and doing a lot of extras casting and extras directing and stuff like that. And I also was the director's assistant a little bit for some really nice directors. So that was very nice as well. I learned a lot and started doing commercials as well.
Your childhood dream came to fruition. Yes.
It came true, but so, and then I did one out of one of the music videos that I did with the one of the biggest bands in Norway came also, like we made this specific universe and they brought that into a concert that they did and they wanted to make a different kind of concert film. So we made this hybrid concert film called The Monkey and the Mouth that is feature length and premiered in Norwegian cinemas for over a week, like, for only one weekend, and it got really great reviews and great response. So that, I think, also enabled me to have a better standing when I was then applying for money for this feature. And yeah, so it's been like gradually building towards this moment.
Yeah.
And I'm very happy.
It's so exciting to see it, all that work pay off and for it to be here. Let's talk about the getting the feature off the ground. It seems like baffling to be pulling together financing. Did you have representation at that time? And what was that process of getting to the point where you're like, okay, there's enough money in the bank or promised to us, we can actually make this?
Yeah, so that took a while. And I have some great producers, but it's quite a high budget for a debut feature. So it wasn't that easy to finance, but we got quite a lot of money from the Norwegian Film Institute and a little bit from the Swedish Film Institute. So in Europe, you have all these different institutes that can give you money.
Funds.
Yeah, funds, which is really great. But we had to then also shoot in three countries because of money and cashback and spend and tax rebate and all of that to make it work. But we only got it greenlit not that long before actually going into shooting. But that felt really nice. And did that answer the question?
It did. Okay. It did.
And when did you finish the film? When
was I completed it in September, October.
Okay.
Yeah.
When do you know that a film is done?
You have deadlines because of money. So you have to like respect those. But I think for us, the editing process, that was a hard one. But we got a little bit of extra time there, which was really helpful. Because it's made out of three parallel stories. Mm-hmm. And to get the balance right and to make it all be one bigger story rather than just having the three separate stories tell each their thing. I think that was a lot of trial to find that balance and what to take out and what to keep in. So, yeah. There we got a bit of extra time. But other than that, you have to kind of stick with the deadlines and that's and try to be as finished as you can before that.
With when you were sort of testing out these different iterations of it, you mentioned screening it in with friends and in smaller rooms. What was that process and how were you sort of like tracking what was working and what was not working?
I mean, we had a lot of, or not that many screenings, but in the same screenings, you could have people that were really enjoyed the film and other people that were like, I didn't feel it at all. Mm. So there was a lot of dread because it took a while to find, or in the editing process, I think it's always like for a very long time, it's just an edit. And then at one time, it turns into a film. Mm-hmm. And you don't really know what's going to do it or when it's going to happen. But usually it's quite late and it's, oh, now it's a film and you don't know really what you did. But, and I had some great editors, but yeah. So I think all the test screenings were good and bad, but then you kind of just have to listen to the people that liked it. Mm-hmm. But also, of course, when there's a lot of people that don't like it, you know that you have to do something, but it's very easy also for people to come with recommendations on what to do to make it better. Mm-hmm. But I have a very like strong gut feeling. So it really pains me to do stuff that doesn't feel right. But sometimes I try it even though, but always end up removing it. But I don't
you got to try it at least. So now because you know that you tried it and it doesn't work or it doesn't align with that gut feeling.
And then you just have to kind of, and also I think in this film, it was really hard with the test screenings because as you know, there's a lot of VFX. Mm. And so a lot of the undead people didn't look undead in the test screenings or they looked like a doll.
They're like, I don't believe that they're undead. And you're like, just wait for it.
It didn't give like the same kind of sensation. Mm. And also the sound is amazing and it gives a lot to the film and the experience, I think. So it was also just about trying to trust ourselves. And I had some great producers that allowed me to do that and also allowed us those extra weeks in the edit, which was very crucial.
Yeah. Did you take time off at all during the edit process?
No, it was really intense because I had two editors because we were trying to reach the deadline. So I was like, because usually when you edit, like you have an editor and you go in and you do a little bit of work and maybe you can go out and think a little bit, but here it's more like go into one room and then as the other one is ready, so you have to go in there and it's like super intense. And instead of having 2 weeks between two screenings, it's like only 1 week, so it's 1 week less of processing, and everything is just way more intense. And it just felt like we were running towards these different screenings all the time. But we had the Christmas break.
Mm-hmm.
So that was quite nice, I think. But yeah.
This is a question I've never asked anyone on the No Film School podcast. What did you do after you finished? Did you take a nap? Did you go on vacation?
You know, the finishing thing, they went because, okay, so the thing, the film was actually supposed to be finished last Easter.
Mm-hmm.
But then it took a while to do the VFX. So that wasn't finished until summer, and then we had to do the grading and final sound mix, but the photographer was on or DP was on another shoot, so we had to do that in August. Mm-hmm. So we did the finalization of the grade in August and also the finalization of the sound mix. Mm-hmm. And then it took we had a lot of issues with the making the DCP. Yeah, the DCP as well. So it dragged out a very long time. So it wasn't like a cathartic moment when it's like, oh no, it's over. That, yeah. So it was a very like slow finishing process. But, or I think now I know when we finished. Uh-huh. That was the last day of the edit of the sound mix.
Mm.
And me and the sound designer and the post producer, and we needed the big party. So we stayed out for way too long, but it was really fun and really needed. So that's what we did. Yes.
Yeah.
We had the farting moment. I just forgot about it, but it was very fun.
That's amazing. Well, as we wrap up here, I'd love to hear your advice for emerging filmmakers, people who are just getting their start and maybe endeavoring on their first short or maybe their first feature. What advice do you have for them?
I think that my advice is to just try and do it, and also try to do it as the best you can.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always better to make something or apply for something or try to do something rather than wait or hold back or be not to dare. I think then just happens and
just do it.
Yes.
And do your best. Well, thank you so much for joining us and congrats on the film. I can't wait for it to be out into the world. I think it's going to shake a lot of people in unexpected ways.
Thank you so much. And thank you for having me.
Thank you so much, Taya, for indulging me in this conversation. She gives off this energy of quiet, calm confidence, something so powerful and enthralling when talking about her work, but also I imagine when working with her on set. I cannot wait to see what comes next for her and stay tuned for this film. You can rate and subscribe to the No Film School podcast across all platforms. You can also follow our work and our additional Sundance coverage at No Film School, and you can follow us on our website at nofilmschool.com. You know the deal. Let us know what you thought of this episode and the film, and thank you so much for listening.